Hello and welcome to episode 293 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, Julia Bellis and Georgina Shute.
Thanks, Matt. So, why don't you start by telling us a bit about what you've been up to this week?
What I have been up to this week? Well, I had a very pleasant weekend in rural Oxfordshire, or Oxfordshire even, with a group of friends who we sort of lived together at various points in the 1990s in London in shared houses. So we got together and had Christmas dinner, because obviously that's what you do in March, and then kind of for a moment forgot that we were now in our 50s until the next morning.
It sounds like a brilliant premise for a movie, actually. Christmas dinner.
In
the 90s.
I think probably one, but if it was a movie, somebody would have to reveal halfway through that they're terminally ill or something like that. So thankfully that didn't happen. But one of the party did get bitten on the nose by a dog.
Which,
he was warned.
Quite dramatic. Did it draw blood?
It did, yes. Quite dramatically.
Did he have to take an
A&E? No, it's fine. Well, I don't know. I've not heard from him, actually, since the weekend. So maybe tetanus has set in and he is no more. But I'm sure Scott's fine. He's gone through worse things in his life. And then I have been work-wise still doing lots of bids. So thinking about that, we had a couple of days of off-site, which was in a co-working place in London's fashionable Shoreditch. Far too fashionable for me. And that was really good, but it was quite exhausting because having co-working days is wonderful because you get get to meet lots of people and spend time with people, but you're doing it all in one really intense period and there's lots of people, and so it's quite cognitively overloading after a while for a wee introvert like me. So that was good though. And other than that, it's sort of just getting ready for the end of school term, and then we've got some madness coming up over the next couple of weeks with scout trips and things. Not that I'm going on a scout trip, but eldest is, so sort of getting stuff ready for that. And so yeah, busy stuff, you know how
it's a bit
it goes.
Of a shock, isn't it? Easter holidays, like, suddenly slap you around the face.
How did that happen? Well, it's very early this year as well, isn't it, because of the weird way that the Christian calendar works with allocating dates for holidays. It's not equally spread. They wouldn't plan it like that these days. So there we go. How's your week been?
Yeah, I've had a really good week, actually. Incredibly unusually, and I keep very luckily doing unusual things on this podcast. I went to the theatre last weekend, went to the National to see Dear Octopus by Dodie Smith, and I love Dodie Smith. I think I read 101 Dalmatians when I was about 9, and then I Capture the Castle when I was 15. And this was a play about a very well-to-do English family in a country estate on the eve of World War II. And it's called Dear Octopus because somebody makes a speech about how a family is like a dear octopus from whose tentacles you can never escape. And that was great. I really enjoyed that.
That's fabulous. Although in my head now, I've got this kind of weird kind of mammal fish thing, which is a dear octopus. And I don't know quite what it looks like.
No, stick some of your nearest and dearest heads on the end of the tentacles or something. Maybe that's an image.
Oh, it's been ages since I've been to the theatre. Really quite a long time. Yeah,
me too. It was a joy to return. It was really good. I should try and... And the reason we went, actually, is because in 2020 I bought pantomime tickets that we then couldn't use because lockdown 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 kicked in. And so I had credit to spend. So I finally spent my National.
Actually got round to it. Good. Georgina, how's your week?
Oh, my week has been quite exciting. So I've done some client work. I went to Manchester, currently staying in Croydon, house sitting for 2 cats. So I had an idea about something called the Kindness Files, which we can talk about in a little bit, which was a very exciting random idea I had on a walk the other day. And my cousin came to stay. So we had a very lovely, wholesome adult girl weekend. It was nice.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. I like that idea of just random ideas coming on a walk.
I've got so many ideas you would not believe. I am an ideas machine. Execution of ideas is where I have a great support system and I'm not so good at. But ideas, oof. By the dozen.
So we'd be a good team, you and me, Georgina, because I'm not great at ideas, actually, but I am quite good at running with other people's ideas.
I might hook you up with that when I talk about the kindness files in a bit. I had this idea about, so I run a business called Kind Too. So we help people at the beginning of their ADHD diagnosis journey, generally senior leaders, leaders in technology, thinking, how have I got to this point and not know I've got ADHD? So helping people through that, but also around spreading kindness. It's around compounding kindness, the power of two. So I had an idea the other day of creating a YouTube series or something around people having kind conversations. I asked 60 people if they wanted to do it with my half-baked idea on Friday. Each of you have a guess. How many people do you think responded to me on Friday and Saturday?
Out of 60? Yeah. Okay, I'm going to be optimistic and say 46.
20.
Not bad.
20, just because I'll be the pessimistic voice in the room.
Yeah, pushing it slightly higher. 52 people.
Wow.
So Gina's half-baked ideas got some excitement and a bit of rallying around, and now I need to make it.
See, yes, that's the thing, isn't it? Because I had a bit of a half-baked idea at the weekend, which is something I'll talk about on a later show. But I put some messages out, and I've got, I think, 16 people who said, yeah, I'll do that. And it's like, oh, damn, this is supposed to only just be like market testing to see that it was a bad idea so I could just knock it on the head. And now look what you've done. And it involves creating another podcast. Dear, like the world needs another podcast. Wow. Anyway, we're going to dig into more about what you are doing and some of these half-formed ideas and maybe some fuller-formed ideas. And so let's crack on. So you mentioned in the intro there that you have a business. It's a business that is focused around neurodiversity and helping people, particularly with ADHD. Tell us a bit, Georgina, though, about how you got to this point. Why is this something that's important to you?
So when I was at school, I was told by a teacher that I would do nothing with my life. 14-year-old bearing a badge of you are an incompetent little human. And so I spent my entire life trying to prove that teacher wrong. It could have gone two ways. And I've always felt a little bit different to other people. I worked out the other day that I've done 22 different roles in my lifetime, in my work career. So I didn't go to uni, have gone through various avenues. And then during lockdown, I was made redundant. And I was also quite poorly. So I spent 7 months off work being very burnt out, and all in kind of this midst, I found Instagram very, very interesting and started looking at ADHD as a thing and thought, some of those things sound like me. And then I realised that quite a lot of tech experience, been working in technology for quite a long time. One of the things that I've really struggled with in my own life is to be able to break really big things down into really small ones. In technology, it's one of the things that we do on quite a regular basis, is help people break really big things down into really small ones. So I decided to create a business to support people going through a similar thing that I did maybe 2 years ago. So at the beginning of my ADHD diagnosis, trying to find anything that would help me make sense of my brain and kind of how I'd got to a point where I'm working in a consultancy out from an outside point of view, looking like I know exactly what I'm doing, but then the swan analogy of maybe I look like what I'm doing, I know what I'm doing, but underneath I'm flapping like mad. And I think it goes back to one of the things that we were talking about earlier of we've been winging it our entire lives. I feel like sometimes of ADHD, it's amplified, because if the world isn't set up to support how your brain works, you're always making pivots and making navigations to try and make something work. I'm left-handed, so most tools are created for right-handed people. So I learned from a very young age to adapt to things. But the reason I decided to start my business is to support people like me 2 years ago, understand that we don't need to keep burning out and keep going through these cycles. I've got a bunch of tools, I've got a bunch of support systems and anecdotes that can help people, and decided to go all in on that last year, and finally in a position where people are paying me money to coach them, which is very exciting. I've done some talks at HMRC, the Financial Times. I've also been able to speak to big companies about this concept of neurodiversity, which, you know, 20 years ago didn't exist, even though it has always existed. But the kind of conversation around neurodiversity is becoming a much, much bigger subject that's being talked about now.
There's definitely, in the time that this show has been in existence, it's been really interesting the extent to which neurodiversity as a theme has gone from something that very few people really understood, and there was a lot of, I guess, either misunderstanding or fear about, through to where it's becoming far more common currency in certainly business conversation. Whether it's at the general population conversation or not, I don't know, but the way that organisations are talking about and thinking about it, and hopefully now providing more support to it, has shifted dramatically. Can we think a bit before we get into the ND side of this, is to just think a bit about burnout and what burnout is as a phenomenon? Because again, that's something that's talked about maybe a lot, but what does it actually mean?
My burnout symptoms were extreme lethargy. I wasn't able to concentrate. I felt like I couldn't exist anymore in the space that I was in. So working in consultancy can be very challenging. It can be very, very rewarding, but it can be very challenging. And it can be quite a pressurized space. And for me, especially with ADHD, the way my brain works, I can miss some of my body's cues. So sometimes I can forget to drink water because there isn't a glass in front of me and I'm so focused on the thing that I'm doing that I've forgotten to eat or drink for hours. And then my body's really hurting because I'm sat in a very slumped over position because I'm really entrenched in something. So missing cues of what my body is trying to tell me. And going back to the burnout thing, for me, it's where, if you think of like a match burning out, you're getting closer and closer to that wick, you know, when it's about to, you blow it out.
Was it those symptoms that led you to seek a diagnosis, or was it something that was on your mind anyway?
I was looking at ADHD as a diagnosis through like Instagram and that kind of thing. And then my body started kind of being really aggy. Like I ended up being diagnosed with an overactive thyroid at the same time. So my body would have been showing me warning signs for years. And my body pushed the big red stop button. And I was off work for 7 months. So a culmination of working myself into the ground, socializing a lot, and not understanding how my brain and body kind of connected, left me in a position where, yeah, I couldn't get out of bed. I was so poorly. My body went into toxicity. I lost about a stone in 6 or 7 weeks. Yeah, it was a lot.
In the context of ADHD, is there, do you think, a greater propensity for people who have ADHD to run risk of burnout because of the very nature of the way in which they're cognitively wired?
Yeah, I think so. So have you come across the spoons theory before? So it's used a lot when people talk about chronic illness. So everybody has a certain amount of spoons that they use per day. So everything costs a spoon. So you give yourself 10 spoons. So you've got 10 spoons a day, and it takes me, I don't know, 2 spoons to get out of bed to load and unload the dishwasher. That could cost me 5 spoons. So I then need to figure out what I do with the other 5 spoons. If I'm going to have one difficult conversation, probably going to cost me another 5 spoons, and therefore by the time it gets to say 9:30 in the morning, I've lost all my spoons. So what do? I then go into this deficit before I've even started the day.
Do you know, that rings bells to me of having small children and getting them up and dressed and out of bed, and by the time you've done all that and got out the door yourself, you kind of feel like you've accomplished an awful lot that day, and now you want to recuperate some way.
Yeah, it's a lot. I don't have children, but I can imagine trying to get one child or multiple children out of the door is a lot of effort. Like, it's a lot of things you need to consider. It's not just we're going now, we're leaving. And if I'm leaving the house, everything needs to have a home, because if it doesn't have a home, then I've forgotten it. So my coat is always in the same place, my bag is always in the same place. every so often I'll take my wedding ring off, for example, because I'm washing the dishes, and then I'll walk off and then I'll be like, oh no, I've lost my wedding ring, where is it? And spend about half an hour looking for my wedding ring and then realise it's by the sink where I left it.
Yeah, and are there things you can do to replenish your spoons, or is that just a night's sleep is the only...
I think there's a concept of 7 different types of rest. So we think of rest as just stopping and not doing very much, like sleep, for example. But you have sensory rest, physical, mental, spiritual, emotional. And there are 2 others, I can't remember what they are off the top of my head. But there are different ways that you can rest your body. For example, sensory, I get overloaded by senses quite a lot. So, I don't know, a journey into the office can be quite tiring for me. It doesn't mean that I won't do it. It means that I have to then think of things that I like to do afterwards. So, or sometimes it can be just laying in a dark room and not to look at my phone because I need to recoup. It can also be food. So making sure I eat good and nourishing food, being in nature, I find really, really helpful. Taking my shoes and socks off and walking on grass, like feeling a connection to that can be really helpful. But I think for me, the biggest thing is to be away from technology because my brain never stops. It never, ever stops. I had a cold a few years ago and I had COVID, and I had COVID for 2 weeks, and it was the first time I can remember where I didn't have any thoughts in my head, where my brain was slow, and it was a very strange experience for me.
I got the chance to talk to somebody who focuses on helping people with burnout, not the ND side of it, but just burnout more generally. And one of the things that he was saying when I caught up for coffee was that one of the big challenges for people burning out with work is that the sorts of things that will lead to burnout are also the sorts of things that will stop people from stopping, because there's a kind of, it builds and it builds and it builds, but the more it builds, the less you feel that you can stop because you've got all this stuff built up. Is that something you relate to?
I think I'm not very good at stopping anyway. So when I stop, I mean, I've got better at it, and also understanding like where my signs are. And I think the conversation with people you trust, I think, is really important, because the more you want to push for a promotion, or you want more money, or you want a bigger car or a fancier house or a prettier set of glasses, pushing for those kinds of things can become the root of why I've burnt out previously. I push for a promotion and then I'm left thinking, oh, I've got, there's been times where I've pushed 80-hour weeks to get pieces of work out for 6 months, and I'm not built to work. I don't think anybody is built to work that kind of prolonged amount of time. But I got a promotion and I was doing very, very well, but I was also very poorly with a good veneer on, so you couldn't really see it. So well, yeah, I would relate to that.
And having been successful in your efforts and got a promotion, there's a new incentive to carry on pushing yourself, isn't there? That yeah. you don't get a promotion and then recuperate and restore.
Yeah, and I think as leaders, it's really, for me anyway, important to understand that there should be some stopping points, because when we came out of lockdown, for example, or even when we went into lockdown and out of lockdown in terms of time periods, for tech companies, things didn't really stop. They carried on. And so people were in this alternate universe trying to figure out what life meant, and still working at the same rate. And then we came out of lockdown to kind of go back to the beginning of, you know, everybody go back to the office, but no recuperation time. We're always pushing so hard to do more things. And I found, and also it's with a sense of privilege that we can have this conversation about choosing to stop, because not everybody has the opportunity to do that, or the, you know, financial ability. But yeah, when my body stopped for 7 months and I was in bed, I was able to live with my husband's family, which was a massive thing to be able to do that. So, I don't know, they fed and watered me for 7 months in a different language that I didn't understand. But they very much looked after me, and I will be forever grateful for them taking me into their home and looking after me when I was at a very low point for the 4 out of those 7 months that I was really ill.
I think it was this weekend, wasn't it, where it was 4 years since the first lockdown in the UK.
Yeah, and I think it was that last Tuesday. It was the 13th of March.
And actually looking back on that time. They're almost, we seem to have gone into a sort of, I don't know, collective amnesia about the weirdness of it all, so we'll just rather forget. And there hasn't really been anything coming out of it where collectively we've been able to take stock and actually deal with what was this amazingly weird period of time.
You've just brought back this memory, actually, because it's my daughter's birthday tomorrow and we've been making chocolate brownies. And 4 years ago, we made chocolate brownies and had this really weird Zoom call with some of her friends, like eating the brownies on Zoom. And nobody'd ever done that before. And it was really bizarre. You know, she'd had to cancel. She's going to have a birthday picnic or something. And yeah, that was the beginning of 3 years. And we've all got a lot better at doing things on Zoom now, haven't we?
Yeah, whether we've been able to cope with all that weirdness, though, is another matter. Yeah. So that's kind of how you've got to where you are now. What is the thing that you do to help people? What is your offer? What's your proposition in actually being able to be, you know, a force for positive help?
It's a one-on-one coaching program, either over 6 or 12 weeks. And we spend some time at the beginning looking at the end, saying, what would you as a person want to achieve in those 12 weeks? How do you want to feel? What would life look like? Whether they want to get a promotion, whether they want to connect with themselves more. And the things we do over those 12 weeks are a course of understanding kind of what people's strengths are, understanding what our cues are as human beings, can be all of the things I forgot to do for myself. Basically, I've created a program around that to support people through going through a similar sort of thing, understanding what your strengths are, understanding what your unique challenges are and how you can put support systems around you to be able to deal with those things and ask for help. Because sometimes we're in environments where asking for help isn't something that's possible, and it's a really rubbish situation to be in. So what support systems can you put in place to then support yourself or find that community?
Everything you've described sounds like incredibly valuable skills for everybody. The world would be better if everyone was better at doing what you just talked about.
And I think that's a really interesting point when we talk about neurodiversity or psychological safety or whatever the new terminology is. I'm not saying they're the same thing, but the idea to me is that we make a place somewhere where you want to be and that you understand yourself and you can bring your best self to that place. It makes sense to me that we would want to create those kinds of spaces.
Yeah, we talk about virtuous circles, don't we, which fits in with your, what was it, kindness chapters idea and compounding the kindness. And you start by doing a good thing and then that triggers 3 or 4 more good things that happen in your team. And there's a sort of cascading effect.
So the things that you were touching on there and back to that reference point earlier about how we're all basically winging it to one extent or another, and ideas about feeling like an imposter. And it feels like those things are quite heavily connected, particularly for people in positions of leadership, because people in positions of leadership, there's so much pressure to be completely infallible. There's so much pressure to be perfect. There's so much pressure to be able to have all the answers. And anybody believes they have all the answers is quite frankly psychopathic. But we all have to pretend to be psychopaths because we're not allowed to pretend that we're anything other than these omnipotent creatures that are in positions of, you know. This is that actually at the core of the issue here is there's just unreasonable expectations on most of us most of the time.
Well, Georgina said something interesting about having trusted relationships. And people who you don't need to pretend.
There's a term in the neurodivergent community or the neurodiverse community around unmasking. And so for me, I feel like I've worn many masks over my career of looking at someone and going, oh, you're doing that. That seems reasonable. I'll do that too. And then when I started to understand more about my own brain, I was thinking, do I actually want to do that? Am I an extrovert? Am I an introvert? Do I want to go out to the pub all the time? No, I don't like loud noises. I don't want to be in an environment where everybody's very where there's lots of noise. I just don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to keep pushing up this career ladder because it's making me poorly. But what I want to do is to be able to, you know, travel to different places, learn Serbian and make the world a slightly better place. And so that's what I'm trying to do. and unmask at the same time. The idea of unmasking is to be able to kind of unpick that kind of stuff of what masks were you putting on and what's underneath. And one of the interesting things for me about unmasking is whether it's a work environment or not, I don't believe everybody deserves all of you, and you can choose to give different people different parts of you. It doesn't mean that, you know, you're not your authentic, in my opinion, you're not your authentic self because you're showing a different part of you to somebody else.
There is a and that's fine. Is that what you're saying? Like,
I think so. They talk about, you know, you be professional at work, and I think there's a slightly grayer area of, I find it very difficult to, you know, shut off my personal life before I come into the office, especially if my office and my home are the same thing. So I think there is that kind of conversation. But to have, you know, an in-depth discussion on a podcast about my innermost feelings, I don't think the world needs to know all of them. Maybe not yet, anyway. The world isn't ready for full Gina. Maybe one day.
Yeah, there's also that horrendously fatuous thing that I've worked in organisations where they bang on about bring your whole self to work. And it's like, if I knew what my whole self was, if you know what my whole self was, you wouldn't be wanting it in the workplace, thank you very much. But it's that we have multiple selves. That's kind of part of how we deal with life. You put yourself into different shapes and you wear different... You have to wear different masks. Everybody has to wear different masks. Again, you know, the people who don't. My ex-late father-in-law was one who thought that you should be just brutally honest at every given juncture. And the amount of emotional damage that he left around himself as a result was just unbelievable. Because you can't work like that.
No, and we all come to this position right now with different life experiences. And also, even your journey to work can really affect you or somebody else during that day. And I think we're all different versions of ourselves at any given, not moment, but, you know, different conversations require different parts of our brains to, I don't know, if you're trying to solve a Rubik's cube, you're going to use a different part of your brain than when you're, you know, feeding a cat, for example.
Yeah, you get different cues from your friends to your colleagues to your family, and you respond differently to those cues, don't you?
It's self-evidently obvious why kindness is an important thing. We should do more of it, but what, where does this fit within your broader work?
Kindness isn't always taught. We're either told or by proxy taught that, you know, you have to be a certain person in the office, for example, and you're meant to know everything, and, you know, you're meant to be stern and firm and all of this kind of stuff. But actually, that can cause real harm, both to the person behaving like that and also the people around them. I've worked in environments where people have screamed at me in the middle of an office because I've made an incorrect decision about whether or not we use one tool over another, for example. And those behaviours, you know, aren't appropriate. That person was probably going through a lot of rubbish in their life to then behave like that. The impact on me in that example was very, very huge. So from a kindness point of view, and why is it important to my business, is that the power to me of having kind conversations can change that narrative. So in a work situation, we don't always have to be that, you know, head down, we're here for 40 hours a week, we're here from 9 till 5, you have to do what I say because I'm the manager, or what are we here to do? And there's always that balance between different roles and what we're trying to achieve. But I think you can do things in a kind way, even if it's a difficult conversation. Just don't be a dick. Don't be a dick. And that's where it comes from, without saying that, in a kind way. And you made a really interesting point earlier of kindness. It's evident. And I think the opposite. Not words have so many meanings in the English language, and intonation and communication is it's so important that we clarify what we mean by words, because we can mean completely different things. Yeah, no, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Did I say yes? Did I say no? What have I said to you? So to clarify what we mean by those things, especially from a product development point of view, whether it's kindness or not, clarification means that you don't go down this massive rabbit warren and, you know, ignore what you're trying to achieve. you can have a kind conversation up front and go, I don't quite know what you meant by that. Can you please rephrase, or can you explain it again?
Again, though, that's tapping into this challenge of the workplace being a place where you can't show weakness, a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding, because it somehow diminishes your professional standing if you ask a question because you don't understand something, which is crackers.
But that is absolutely the opposite. The sort of instructions to generate psychological safety, you know, it is come to the work from a place of curiosity, ask questions that you don't know the answer to, reach the answers together with your team, and leaders, display your vulnerability. You know, don't be afraid to acknowledge that you don't have all the answers. And it is interesting how loads of these expected behaviours seem to be the absolute opposite of that. And I wanted to ask you, Georgina, actually, as a coach, do you feel that people, let me think about this, do you feel able to give people permission to be kind and give people permission to behave differently? Do they need that from somebody like you?
In a really interesting, so some of my clients have said to me, without me asking them, thank you for giving me this safe space where I can understand myself in a different way. So I'm supporting people that are in their late 30s, early 60s. I'm working with people that, you know, have worked for a very long time. They've been in environments for a very long time where these things aren't taught. And going back to that kind of vulnerability and understanding what safe is space and what space is safe and what isn't, I think is very important. So what I want to give to my clients is that non-judgmental space, because I know what it's like to be in that situation, to be judged. But I really try in work environments to ask the hashtag silly or stupid questions. And I think it's a leading by example thing for someone to go, oh, actually, I didn't get that either. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. And the humanizing yourself in leadership is a very important quality to get people to follow or to be able to challenge you if you've done the wrong thing. Because leaders aren't always right. They may have missed something. They may have completely misunderstood something. And if you don't create that space where you can challenge other people, create that kind, safe space, then, you know, you're going to send a rocket to space and you've put the wrong amount in the rocket. Do you remember there was like two different groups of people working on a rocket, and one was working in English tons, one was working in Americans? If there was an environment where someone said, surely someone said in that room, I think we're using different metrics here. No, I've got it right. I mean, I'm assuming, obviously, I'm not a rocket scientist. just to clarify.
That's back to your point about language and meaning, isn't it? Those two words are the same, and you do need to dig into that to discover that crucial difference. And I did want to ask you about ADHD and subtext. Does it help or hinder when it comes to understanding hidden meaning behind people's words, which English, as you say, is so full of?
I think it can be both. So I can read subtext in almost anything. So I can feel an energy of a room, which is in some senses really, really helpful. So if I'm facilitating a session with 20 people and I can feel the energy is rough, I can then use that to re-pivot and to navigate the conversation into something, or I can stop that conversation. It gives me that ability as a facilitator, for example, to change something. I could also read subtext in a message, or if someone says, can we have a chat at 4:30? Oh my goodness me, have I done something? And I'm reading all of this hidden meaning in a message. And language here is very fascinating. So my husband is Serbian, and Serbian is a very direct language, and English is not a direct language. So we've had to spend a lot of time and a lot of work understanding how we communicate with each other, because our communication styles are very different. And it's taken a lot of work to be kind to myself when I don't understand something, to then go, I don't really understand what you mean by that. Can you tell me? And that goes back to that kindness and that safe space, and that whatever relationship you're in, romantic, work relationship, I don't know, whatever, to be in a place where you can go, I don't quite understand what you mean by that. Can you explain it to me again? Is so powerful to get to a group answer. And even if it's that what people don't agree with something, you can at least be respectful about it.
So do you communicate with your husband in English or Serbian or both?
Oh, so I've been learning Serbian for about 2.5 years. So we will talk in Serbian, but more of a... So my husband speaks English fluently. So our base language is English. So we will communicate in Serbian if I want to practice something. With some other people in his hometown, our base language is Serbian. So my Serbian's not amazing, but I can have a conversation. Because our base language is English, me and my husband, it's much easier for us to speak in English. But speaking to, I don't know, my husband's parents, who his mum is learning English so she can speak with me, which I think is incredible. We're learning each other's languages. But I will speak with them in Serbian because that's our group language.
And do you feel that you communicate differently when you're talking in the second language?
Yeah, I feel like I'm a different person. I feel like I have to use words in a different way and gesture in different ways. And also because the language is a lot more direct, I can ignore the waffle of my English vocabulary and I can get right to the heart of what I want because I don't have the luxury of a massive vocabulary right now.
I think you're freed from the weight of subtext, actually, aren't you? You just use the words available to you to get the message across.
That's really interesting. I didn't think about it like that. Yeah. Because I think sometimes I can get quite frustrated that I don't understand something. And the English language and the way we're taught it, the way we're taught other languages, if we're taught them at all, is that you need to speak it perfectly before you can actually speak. The best way for me to learn anything is to do the thing. So if you're learning a language, the best way to learn it is to just start speaking it, is to mess up the people that you're speaking to in the other language, if they're, you know, calm. It's quite interesting in a language that's so different to yours and people don't understand why you're learning it. I mean, they know for love or whatever, but people are a lot more patient in Serbian to me when I don't understand something. And it took me about 2 years to be able to want to have a conversation without feeling bright red and really nervous. At the beginning, I was so scared to speak to anybody because I didn't want to be misunderstood, or I didn't want to offend anyone, or I didn't want to be able to express what I needed. However, if I were to learn another language, the tool that I would take with me into that next language is to learn a bit, practice a bit, learn a bit more, practice a bit more. I think it's a skill for life.
Learn through doing, isn't it? It is such a great lesson that I think you can apply to so much. And we were, I don't know if education has changed actually, brought up to hold off doing something until we could do it well. You talked about reading the energy of a room. Does that translate at all to virtual chats like this on Zoom or some other platform?
You get less visual cues, but I can still, I mean, I'm not a superhuman person and I don't know how I do it. It's something that is in my body, in my brain. I don't know how, but yeah, I'd say I could still read a room on Zoom. I mean, it's not perfect. There are still times where I could completely miss the mark or make a joke where people are like, can you not make jokes right now?
I don't think there's much difference actually. I think the problem often though is that the reason it's hard to read a room on Zoom is because nobody's paying bloody attention to the meeting,
which says something in itself to me.
Exactly. Yeah,
which
yeah.
says something in itself. There was a really interesting picture a little while ago of a study of people in back-to-back meetings and what it does to your brain versus what it does to the calmness of your brain if you have breaks in between meetings. And the difference in how your brain processes information is massive. Back-to-back meetings are a massive problem for concentration.
That's so interesting. It reminds me of, in my youth, I was into running and ran the London Marathon. And we had this deal for every hour of running, we'd walk for a minute And that minute walking just lets all your lactic acid levels and all sorts of things go back to normal. And it's a similar sort of idea, isn't it? Short break in between meetings just lets everything calm down and you're less likely to get overloaded.
Because if every conversation you're in is an overloading conversation, then it's pouring more water into a full cup. There isn't anywhere else for it to go. And so emotions get a lot more heated. I don't know, if you have more difficult conversations further along in the day, so it can kind of add to at what point we should have these types of conversations, or can we just stop partway through this meeting? Should this even be a meeting? And going back to that kindness thing of it's kind to have those conversations. It's kind to say, can we just stop for a minute? Because this is too much.
Well, and also to be aware that, you know, you've created space for your clients to have these conversations with you. You can create space for your team members to have breaks and recharge. And it doesn't need to be a significant time period, does it? A couple of minutes to have a cup of tea or go for a walk around the garden.
I think there probably is an optimum amount of time as well. Because if you gave me 2 hours off, I'd probably just sit on the sofa and watch telly, which sometimes it's what your body needs. But that quick burst of, a reset, recharge allows you to have that sip of water. So then you can add something else into that cup rather than it always continuously being full. And then, if you think like a full suitcase and you add more into it, and then that kind of cartoon suitcase explosion. And then there's, your knickers are on top of the washing line or whatever.
Well, fantastically diverse conversation that was. That's good. Possibly the most vivid visual metaphor on which to end an interview of the entire show's history. So thank you, Gina, for that. That's wonderful.
You're welcome.
We're at that point in the show where we think about the forward-looking side of things and the week ahead. So what's the week ahead looking like for you?
So I'm house-sitting at the moment. So I'm house-sitting a Maine Coon and a British Shorthair, and this is the last week in this house. So I will be going to a country manor house in Kent next week to look after a dog. In between these 2 points in time, I have some coaching sessions, I have some client work to do, and I'm also going to meet some friends for a coffee tomorrow. So I'm hoping to have a bit of nourishment and, yeah, lots of animals. Very excited.
I'm quite jealous of Georgina's country manor house in Kent, actually. That sounds amazing. It sounds like it's probably not a holiday, but it sounds like it could be a little mini holiday. I don't have any little mini holidays. I am going to run my first ever lean fishbowl coffee, which is an idea nicked from John Fulton, who is a sort of a friend of the show, I think, where we crowdsource the agenda, like a lean coffee, and then run a fishbowl conversation where people can come and contribute sitting on 4 chairs in the middle of the room. And we're going to be talking about what delivery leads can do to help create or encourage psychological safety. So I'm hoping it'll be quite kind of chaotic and fun. And I'll let you know how that goes.
Yeah, very good. I had to say the fishbowl, I always think of it as the empty chair. And my proudest management consulting related claim to fame is the empty chair is, I think, a technique that was invented by Charles Handy. But if not, it's definitely something that Charles Handy does. And Charles Handy was somebody who's big influence on my dad. He's written some amazing books. I got to meet him at a conference about 6 years ago, and I took part in an empty chair session that was actually facilitated by Charles Handy, which was quite something. So that's good.
That's a good story.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we've got Easter week in the week ahead, so I am going to be mostly, I think, hopefully, touch wood, hosting my parents who are coming down, assuming my dad's current health is up to it. And so we'll have not only grandparents in the house, but also the grandparents' dog, which the boys are exceptionally excited about because we don't usually have animals in the house other than the aforementioned two teenagers. So there'll be a lumbering golden poo or whatever the thing is called. It's a golden retriever, poodle cross, and my parents as well. So that'd be nice. And then it's just sort of chuggy work stuff really as well as that. So it is Easter weekend coming, which means that there will be no show next week. We're taking a little break. We will be back though the week after on the 8th of April, and I believe our guest that week is the head of Open UK, Amanda Brock, joining us for, I think, probably the third time to talk about the current state of all things open in the UK. So that'd be fantastic. Between now and then, there's plenty of back catalogue to explore. Don't go before episode about 47, though, because they're really, really ropey. They've got better as we've got older, like many things. Gina, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a fantastic conversation this week.
Thank you for having me.
And Julia, good to see you. It will be a different pairing, as ever now. All the excitement when we're back on the 8th. And that's when we will return. So until then, have a good Easter. And we'll see you on the 8th of April.
Thank you for listening to WB40. You can find us on the internet at wb40podcast.com and all good podcasting platforms.